documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, watching media talking heads explode and broadcasting live from media. Let's try this again. Broadcasting live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next 3 hours, along with Vicki Davis. Nice to have you with us as we once again document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. Today is the 28th of January, 2017. Good to have you with us once again, ladies and gentlemen, and good morning, Vicki.
Good morning, Darren.
Still got the music doing its thing in the background there. Off to a kind of a rough start. Man, I woke up just about a half hour ago. I guess it was about 45 minutes ago. So anyway, throw some coffee on and try to get myself moving here. It's been kind of busy.
Since probably about 3 a.m., I don't know. You know, so I've been watching videos and, you know, I'll be ready to go back to bed right after the program.
Yeah, well, usually the way I do things is I normally am up most of the night doing show prep, and I try to take a brief nap before the show, and then once I, because my week, I actually start planning for the show in earnest on Wednesday, and I try to kind of keep track a little bit about what's going on Monday and Tuesday, and then Wednesday, I really kind of start collecting stuff. There's certain things that I have on the internet to make sure that I don't miss things, and I don't always have a chance to go through everything, but I automatically capture a number of different RSS feeds so that I have them in case I need them. And then I try to go through at some point and clear all that out. But I start collecting things in earnest on Wednesdays. And then, you know, depending upon what's going on in my life outside of the show, I'll either do the heavy lifting on Thursday or, you know, a lot of times it comes down to Friday, the last minute, unfortunately. And so those are usually long nights.
Yep.
But it is what it is. Hey, you know what? There's a lot of weird stuff going on. One of the things that I'm concerned about is education. And I know that you're concerned about it too. I see things going to hell in a handbasket on the education front, Vicki.
Yeah.
The colleges have become centers of, microaggressions and white privilege, you know, all these little buzzwords to identify how bad people are being to each other. And now there's a class being offered apparently at Ohio State University, which is supposed to detect and respond to microaggressions and white privilege. So that story is in the College Fix. And then there's another one. And this is just lets you know how bad things are really getting. Now they're expanding this whole concept of privilege to people who are right-handed. They're actually saying that if you're right-handed, you need to check your privilege. It's unbelievable. And then I get this on January 13th. Because I, you know, being a talk show host, I get a number of different emails from PR firms. And usually it's, you know, people like wanting to get their, you know, authors on the program and stuff. And a lot of times it doesn't rise to the level of anything that would, you know, go along with the show. You know, it's not really a format of the show, so I don't bother to book them. But this one I found kind of interesting, and even though I didn't really care to book them, I thought the email itself was interesting. It says, Darren, with Inauguration Day coming on January 20th, I'm writing a story for Govern America on an emerging trend in how people talk politics. Here's a hint. It involves presidential emojis. Question, could the future of political discussion lie outside of speech? and the written word? Answer, yes. And emojis as political expression are the name of the game. The way we express our opinions is dramatically shifting from verbal to visual, and President-elect Trump is leading the charge. So they go on here to talk about, you know, various emojis that they're promoting. They said as if 140 characters wasn't short enough, Americans will soon be able to conduct entire conversations in emojis and stickers. The move toward emojis as political expression is real. Trump and Twitter had a disagreement in December after the platform refused to allow an emoji version of the hashtag Crooked Hillary. You know, and they go on, and they got a company anyway that's selling these emojis, and they're talking about Obama dropping the mic, Obama eating ice cream, Trump peeking over his wall, Trump bathing in a bathtub of money. You know, so we're going further and further away from language. I remember when Nancy was here, we were talking about, you know, I played clips from a tech show in which we were, you know, they were saying that they had this whole language emerging with these little cartoon characters, these little emoji, you know, smiley faces and things like that. Yeah. It's like a new international language.
It's a movement away from logic and reason and the ability to think. They're getting these young people to operate from the brainstem rather than, you know, the higher order thinking. And it's intentional. It's to break down the society. And you can see the effects of it. These ridiculous young people out in the streets, a young white guy saying, screaming at other white guys, "You're a white male." I mean, how crazy is that?
Yeah, and it's refreshing once in a while to see somebody, you know, like I saw a gentleman, a young black man on Twitter, trying to school a white girl who's holding a sign and everything. She's an extreme liberal, and he's saying, look, these inner cities are dangerous places for me. He says, I can't even go into a black neighborhood because the vast majority of violence is black on black. He says, so how do you think that makes me feel? He says, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, he was really polite about it, but at least there's some of them that are getting it, and they're understanding that there's a bigger problem here than some white guy somewhere trying to hold them back. There's real problems, and without recognizing what the real problems are, we're never going to solve them.
I watched a video a couple of days ago, and it had an excerpt from that Russian KGB guy, that Barry Yakimov or whatever his name was, but it was about the guy that was talking was listing the five things necessary for mind control, and the part of it that was really frightening was that the Russian guy said that once this methodology, this system has been applied to a society, there's really no going back. Have a lost generation.
If not more. Yeah,
yes.
I could see why that would be, because once you get these people brainwashed into thinking certain ways, it's almost impossible to break that. I mean, you've introduced a whole new... Just take the privilege thing, for instance. How many people are going to ever let go of that genuinely believe that? Well, yeah. You know, you just think that way because of your privilege. You know, I mean, we're all going to have differences. But to have that kind of accusation, you can't divorce yourself from that. There are some things that what they've done is they've defined certain groups that there's no redemption for you. There's no path for you to get... To ever blend in or assimilate with the general population. They've made these lines to the point where nobody can ever intermingle again. I don't know. It's really weird.
There is no resolution because...
And that's the way they want it, isn't it?
Yes. It's okay, you know what I believe it is? I think that what happened to our society is an operation of the Fabian socialists. Been working on it for a very, very long time. And this chaos that we're seeing in our society, these young people who are actually freaks, you know, with all their tattoos and their piercings and, you know, the whole thing, it's really Dadaism, which is what happened to Nazi Germany, you know, to Germany at the time when the Nazis rose to power. And I think it is a cultural operation against civilized society.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Does Trump fit into this Dadaism?
Trump is the counter to it. He is the rise of the strong man to put a stop to it. And we're all happy to have him. And hopefully, it won't go like Nazi Germany.
Well,
you know, but
see, the problem, I'm conflicted over, to this day. I'm still conflicted over Trump. There are some great things happening, and I want to get into some of that today. But there's also some things that are very troubling. You know, and every time it seems like I whenever I feel, I almost feel guilty for feeling good about some of this stuff, because I know that, well, number one, I think part of the problem is our side isn't used to winning anything, and so when anything good happens, you think, okay, what's the downside?
Right.
What am I missing here?
Yeah, when am I going to get the sucker punch?
Exactly. And so there's that problem. And then the other thing is that there are genuinely some problems associated with it. I don't know. Part of it could be ignorance on his part. And there are other things that are just not being dealt with. The underlying infrastructure of the police state, as you know, is all the IT stuff. All of the Internet of Things and all of the connected this and connected that. And I see Trump as being all in on that. I think he wants all that stuff. He said he was a big-time Homeland Security guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the problem, you know. It just depends on at what layer you want to look at things, you know, at what layer you're looking at. I want strong Homeland Security because I know that, you know, they're moving Muslims into our country, young military age male Muslims. Mm-hmm. And I
guess it's how you define
it. You know what the objective is.
Yeah, okay? It's how you define it. I want strong national security. Mm-hmm. I don't know what this new homeland security thing is all about. I have a pretty good idea.
There's a whole big East German style Stasi in home scam security. Mm-hmm. You've got the Southern Poverty Law Center feeding information into the fusion centers, and they are the very people who are making it safe for all these freak young people out in the streets. Yeah. So if you give them more money for more home scam security, then it's less secure for us.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, they. By the way, I did have a chance to. I did have a chance to lift some audio from that hearing you sent me. I know I didn't respond to your email, but I had a chance to go in and I got a couple of sound bites from it. I would have liked to have made it through the whole thing. In fact, the hearing actually looked pretty good, and so I may end up going through later on after I do the show notes and listening to the whole thing.
You're talking about the Russian hacking one?
Yeah, the Russian hacking and vote fraud. You know, that's the thing is folks, a hearing was scheduled on U.S.-Russian relations in the 2016 election, is what it was called. And that was an open and, I would say, honest, really quite honest discussion by intelligence analysts regarding the claims that Russia hacked the U.S. elections and that they were attempting to undermine the process, or at least change the results. One of the speakers was former chief of Russia analysis for the CIA and an advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney. His name was George Beebe was his name. He started off talking about the need to fight your own confirmation bias, as he called it, and to look directly at the evidence objectively.
So when we approach a question like this, we really have to make conscious efforts to account for all those tendencies.
Okay, now I should have set this up a little better. What he's talking about here is how, as an intelligence analyst, how do you figure out whether or not the claims that Russia really hacked our election or not are valid? How do you know? He's talking about fighting your own confirmation bias. In other words, you go into this thing with a predetermined bias that you think a certain thing, or you have a certain set of suspicions. You have to fight against that your own confirmation bias. So how do you do that? How do you look at the evidence objectively? All right.
So when we approach a question like this, we really have to make conscious efforts to account for all those tendencies. So I want to do that briefly with the evidence that we've got in the case of Russia's role in the elections. And I'd like to focus only on information that is in the public domain. I obviously don't know what classified information there might be out there, and it's certainly possible that the intelligence community has conclusive diagnostic evidence about what actually happened and why. But what we do have in the public domain, I think, raises some red flags that we really need to consider. The first is in the area of attribution. Who done it, in other words? The report says that this was an operation that was explicitly ordered by President Putin with some specific goals in mind. The forensic evidence that we have in the public domain is not particularly impressive in this regard. There are a couple of things that I think I want to address on this. One is the number of intrusions themselves. According to the forensic data, there were two separate intrusions into the Democratic National Committee email servers. The first occurred in the summer of 2015. This was around the time that now President Trump was first announcing his candidacy for the presidency. The second occurred in March 2016. There were two separate groups, according to this forensic data, that actually intruded into the email servers. And they each took roughly the same sets of information. Now, this is unusual. If you're looking to maintain operational security, you really don't want to intrude into the same target multiple times. The more often you attempt to penetrate a particular target, the more likely it is that you're going to be caught. And the fact that they went after the same information raises questions about whether these things were actually centrally directed or not. The proponents of the so-called Kremlin ordered it thesis explain this by saying, well, this is the fruit of bureaucratic rivalry. We had one intelligence organization, the GRU, that penetrated on one occasion, and another, the FSB, that penetrated on a separate occasion. That is a very plausible explanation. Certainly there is a lot of bureaucratic fighting that goes on in Russia, as with many governments. But I think in this particular case, we ought to consider an alternative hypothesis, which is perhaps these were not centrally directed intrusions. And to combat our tendency toward confirmation bias, I think it behooves us to consider alternative hypotheses, such as could these have been, for example, hacktivists that were at work here? Could this have been a false flag operation? The evidence that we have here is consistent with all of these hypotheses.
I find it interesting now that intelligence people are using the term false flag operation.
Yeah. Well, earlier in that video, they said, one of them said, there really is not, the evidence is not there. All of the intelligence agencies agreed that it was Russia, but there's really not evidence to support that.
Well,
real evidence.
I think he just pretty much said that there.
Mm-hmm.
He said certainly the evidence is lacking, and that there's red flags about the evidence.
Right.
I think it's fascinating. The problem is the media is not going to focus on a hearing like this. So unless somebody has been listening to C-SPAN like you have, the average person isn't going to get much airplay.
No, that's true. It probably won't get any. But the pattern of what he said, you know, that there were two separate break-ins, they went after the same information. That's the kind of thing that IT operations do. And we know that HomeScan Security was testing state systems to see if they could break in. And who was it, Secretary of State in Georgia, wrote a letter of complaint to HomeScan Security.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the kind of thing that a security firm would do, testing to, you know, first of all, to see if they could get in. They got in, waiting a few months, see if they get it fixed, and then try it again, go after the same thing.
Yeah, I think he addresses some of that. He goes on to describe some of the reasons not to believe that the hacking was actually done, in fact, by the Russians.
Second red flag is the sloppiness of the operations themselves. In the cyber world, the Chinese have a reputation for being quite brash and sloppy in their intrusions. The analogy might be one of an intruder into a home that breaks your window and marches around your house in muddy boots and leaves fingerprints everywhere, almost as if they don't really care if we're able to figure out that China was behind the operations. The Russians, on the other hand, have typically been more like the intruder that you don't even know they entered your home, and 2 years after the fact, you figure out, boy, something's missing. How did that happen? They're quite stealthy. In this particular case, however, the operations were almost amateurish. They left all kinds of indicators that would point toward Russians.
Okay, now I want to interrupt here again and remind everybody, this guy is a former CIA. Okay, this guy is an intelligence analyst who advised Dick Cheney. I just want to make that clear. This isn't some bozo giving his offhanded opinion. This is an intelligence analyst. This guy does this professionally, and he's giving you his professional opinion.
The compiling of the information that they took, for example, all took place during Moscow business hours. It's an easy thing to fix. You know, even your entry-level hackers can figure out how to program your compiling so that it doesn't leave that kind of clue. Some of the emails that were leaked included metadata that was put in using Cyrillic keyboards. One of the users that was behind those leaks had a code name of Felix Edmundovich, which apparently was a clear reference to Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet Cheka. Now, these are the kinds of things that are not typical of Russian cyber operations, which makes you wonder, gee, was it really them? Could it have been a false flag? Or did they want to be found? Which is another possibility that we ought to consider, which gets to intent. And the last thing is the level of sophistication of these intrusions. Not very high. The cyber experts looked at the malware code that was used and essentially said, look, this was off-the-shelf malware, widely available internationally. Anybody basically could have done this. We're not dealing with custom-crafted code that was something you would automatically start saying, boy, you need a sophisticated intelligence level operation to undertake this. So all of these things are not to say, gee, this shows that the Russian government wasn't behind it. Not at all. I think that's a very plausible hypothesis. But it does, I think, behoove us to address alternative explanations here. When you fail to do that, you can get into trouble. It affects the confidence that you have in your judgments. And there are big implications behind some of the judgments that we're talking about here. And before we go down the road of saying, you know, we're certain about certain things, I think we really owe it to ourselves to think hard about whether the facts that we have in front of us can be explained in other ways. And we got into trouble in this regard with the famous Iraq WMD example. I would hope that we can learn some of the lessons that led to failure in that case, apply them here so that we don't repeat those mistakes.
So I thought it was really interesting and important that he made the distinction about the fact that the code that was used was just stuff that was available freely in the wild. There wasn't anything that looked like it was sophisticated or developed by a state actor or anything like that. This was all code that, as he said, anybody could have done this.
Yeah, I really appreciated the way that he went through that logical analysis in a step-by-step way. That's really kind of a painful thing to do, you know, for people that are used to doing that for a living, you know, to back it up. Mm-hmm. Because usually, you know, people that do this kind of analysis, they come up with the answer almost instantaneously. But when you have to back it up and go through it piece by piece to explain it to people, it's very, very painful. But
well, what's painful for a lot of people, I think, is the fact that you have all these organizations being politicized. And I think it, as he said, it really does a huge disservice because nobody's going to believe anything the agency says from this point forward.
Right. Well, our entire government has been politicized. Every agency of government has become politicized and corrupt.
Yeah.
In the process.
Very unfortunate.
Yeah, we can talk about that on the other side.
All right. Sounds good. Bottom of the hour. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. Our website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. Vicki's website is thetechnocratictyranny.com. That's thetechnocratictyranny.com. It's linked up with the main website. And you can go there and read all of her research and do a lot of studying because there's a lot of outward links in everything she does, she documents. So I highly encourage you to check out her work, The Technocratic Tyranny. I know you spend a lot of hours out at it, Vicki.
Yeah, I do.
It's a labor of love.
Yeah, it is. I thought it was when I figured out something really very wrong was going wrong with our country, I made it my business to try and figure out what it was.
There you go. Also, before the break, you were talking about our government being corrupted, and you made the statement that the entire government, every agency, has been politicized, and I think you wanted to say something else about that.
First of all, let me back up and say about the voting system. Mm-hmm. When you stack up all the evidence, including the HAVA Act and Jay Johnson declaring it critical infrastructure. And years ago, they had a requirement for all the states to have a computerized voter registration database. The logical conclusion is that HomeScan Security is ready now to nationalize the voter registration database. And in order to, because it's such a sensitive area, you have to have a crisis big enough to justify the solution that you want to implement.
Yeah, it's kind of like Rahm Emanuel said.
You never want a serious crisis to go to waste. And what I mean by that, it's an opportunity to do things that you think you could not do before.
There you go.
Right.
Hegelian
and if you,
dialectic.
And if you don't, if a crisis doesn't occur naturally, then you create one. And mm-hmm. so what they did is they created one.
Yep.
That's what I believe they did with this whole hacking story.
Yeah. And how much of this, I don't doubt that there may have been some hacking.
I'm sure they get hacked all the time, but the whole thing about Russians did it, you know, that's ridiculous.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, we just got evidently all of our anybody with a security clearance during the Obama administration had their information credentials, all of their personal data, I guess presumably social security numbers and everything taken. And I know people with security clearances. I know a couple of people with security clearances. You know, they're contractors, do things for the government. And they're very nervous about this. It's a real concern for them. I mean, these people, I mean, the Office of Personnel Management was hacked. And I mean, it wasn't just a mild, small hack. I mean, this thing, to me, rises to a much greater level than even the election system. I mean, you can fix an election system. All you have to do is go to paper ballots. It's a no-brainer. Try to hack a paper ballot. I mean, you can't do that. So this is a fixable problem. A much greater scandal is what happened during the Obama administration, and nobody in the media is talking about that one.
Right. It was almost not covered at all.
It wasn't covered at all. Well, it may have been mentioned. I shouldn't say that. It may have been mentioned, but it wasn't
C-SPAN.
Much of a mention. Yeah, me too.
I watched the hearing on C-SPAN.
Me too.
But yeah. I don't recall it being covered in the mainstream media.
I think it was a mention. I think they mentioned it and moved on. This is what they should have focused on for months and months and months and months. There should have been investigations. Well, there was a federal hearings about it. We played the audio, you know, clips of it on the show. But this was a big deal.
Yeah, well, that goes right into what I was going to talk about right after the break,
mm-hmm.
which is that all of our systems of government using off-the-shelf software. And they implemented TQM and got rid of all of the senior
TQM,
IT.
You got to explain for new listeners what TQM is.
Total Quality Management.
Okay.
And it was a new management scheme, supposedly for the new ways of doing things. And basically it was to collapse the hierarchical structure within corporations, empowering all of the lower level people in an organization to become entrepreneurial
mm-hmm.
at their jobs, which is just an absurdity that I can't even begin to tell you.
Are you talking about government jobs?
Well, this happened, TQM happened in government, and mm-hmm. it happened in corporations.
Well, I know when you go to the Secretary of State, they call you a customer.
Yeah, well, that was part of the whole new paradigm of
see, to me, a customer is somebody who's there voluntarily, not by extortion, but hey, you know?
Yeah, you're right. But it all started with privatization. That's where I pinpoint it is the movement towards privatization, which in the long term scheme of things, really the intent was to ultimately collapse our government and go under a global management system.
Yeah.
But IT systems were always done by contractors. You know, when you did a new IT system, they would bring in contractors because the government didn't really keep the caliber of people that you would want to have, you know, designing a new system. They maintained the old systems. And besides that, the development of a new system takes 100% of your time. And so if you're doing that, you really can't maintain the old system at the same time. And so they always brought in contractors. Hmm. Well, if you're redesigning your whole entire government, they brought in contractors for everything, absolutely everything, you know, HHS, Social Security, the income tax system, just, you know, name a system of government. And they brought in IT and then rewrite those systems all at once, which no professional would ever recommend doing so many new systems at once. Well, and just wholesale replacements too, not fixing an old one, you know, upgrading it and updating it. No, you know, they went, you know.
Well, I would say arguably, a lot of people say that old systems are not as good as new systems. I would argue that old systems that have been around for a while could have, and in some cases that might be true, but old systems that have been around for a while have a chance at being patched and have a chance at being hardened. And this is the problem I have with Microsoft, you know, shoving off Windows newer versions at us all the time and making it to where the old tried and proven systems are degraded to the point where nobody will use them anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know what? People don't know anything about systems inside of a corporation unless they've worked with them. A system did not exist if it did not fulfill a purpose, a function. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they made a whole big to-do about Y2K. But by the time that last decade, before the year rollover came about, most of the systems had already been converted. IBM had a database system called DB2 that they started selling in about the early 1980s, I believe, that already had an automatic forward date position. But the reason why systems were developed, you know, with when I first started in the business, the year in some of the systems was a single digit. Hmm. And so there was a problem with the decade rollover in 1980. The reason why they did that, it wasn't stupidity on the part of the programmers. It was because disk space,
it was limited,
was more expensive mm-hmm. than programmer time.
Yep. I remember them talking about Y2K that way.
Yeah. And so that was the trade-off. You know, they the focus of the programmer was to be as absolutely efficient in the use of disk space as you could possibly be. Even if it took you an extra week to write a program, it didn't matter because your time was cheap, hardware was expensive.
Yeah.
So, and you know, in the 1980s, that turned around where, you know, the hardware was cheap and programmers became expensive.
Yeah, and now they're putting a terabyte into a thumb drive. Mm-hmm. Figure that one out.
Right, right. And when they got sit on your desktop that had more power than the 360 Model 30 that I learned on, you mm-hmm. know, in the 1970s, then the hardware and the software became cheap and programmers became expensive. So they tried to go cheap with programmers, and what they got was a disaster. And what I believe ultimately has happened with our government is an administrative coup d'etat.
Yeah, I totally believe that. We've talked a lot about that here. Wrapping up this vote fraud thing, I know Donald Trump is investigating. He just announced he was talking with somebody on ABC News at an interview he did. He's launching an investigation into the real vote fraud, which I do believe there was real vote fraud. I think it was predominantly the Democrats trying to steal the election for Hillary Clinton. I think what they didn't count on. See, here's the thing. I think what's going on here is I think that there's a certain amount of voter fraud. They do just enough. That's probably the reason why they have so many polls, is to find out how much they have to do in order to tilt the election. And this is another reason why we don't ever have a landslide election anymore. You know, I remember back in time, we had some elections that weren't close. Now it seems like every single one is closed, and we're always told, oh, you're a divided nation. That's the reason why every election is close. We're so divided. The reality is that I think they're dinking with everything, including the polls, but at the end of the day, they want to be able to manipulate things and tilt it in whatever direction, and I really don't think Donald Trump was supposed to have won. But now they've got to figure out a way to make this work for them. Anyway, Trump is saying now he's going to launch an investigation into the vote fraud.
I'm going to tell you over the next 4 weeks.
I want to ask you about something you said this week right here at the White House. You brought in congressional leaders to the White House. You spoke at length about the presidential election with them, telling them that you lost the popular vote because of millions of illegal votes, 3 to 5 million illegal votes. That would be the biggest electoral fraud in American history. Where is the evidence of that?
So let me tell you, first of all, it was so misrepresented. That was supposed to be a confidential meeting, and you weren't supposed to go out and talk to the press as soon as you were. But the Democrats viewed it not as a confidential
meeting. But you have tweeted about the millions of votes.
Sure you do, and I do, and I'm very... And I mean it. But just so you know, it was supposed to be a confidential meeting. They turned it into a non-confidential. Number two, the conversation lasted for about a minute. They made it, somebody said it was like 25% of the deal. It was hardly even discussed. I said it, and I said it strongly, because what's going on with voter fraud is horrible. That's number one. Number two, I would have won the popular vote if I was campaigning for the popular vote. I would have gone to California, where I didn't go at all. I would have gone to New York, where I didn't campaign at all. I would have gone to a couple of places that I didn't go to. And I would have won that much easier than winning the Electoral College. But as you know, the Electoral College is all that matters. It doesn't make any difference. With that being said, if you look at voter registration, you look at the dead people that are registered to vote, who vote, you look at people that are registered in two states, you look at all of these different things that are happening with registration, you take a look at those registration, you're going to find, and we're going to do an investigation on it.
But 3 to 5 million illegal votes.
Well, we're going to find out, but it could very well be that much. You have people that are registered who are dead, who are illegals, who are in two states. You have people registered in two states. They're registered in New York and in New Jersey. They vote twice. There are millions of votes, in my opinion. Now, I'm going to do an investigation.
You're now president of the United States.
I want the voting process to be legitimate.
But now, when you say, in your opinion, millions of illegal votes. That is something that is extremely fundamental to our functioning democracy, a fair and free election.
Sure.
You say you're going to launch an investigation
into
this.
Sure, done.
What you have presented so far has been debunked. It's been called false.
Take a look at the Pew reports.
I called the author of the Pew report last night, and he told me that they found no evidence of voter fraud.
Really? Then why did he write the report?
He said no evidence of voter fraud.
Excuse me. Then why did he write the report, according to Pew report? Then he's groveling again. You know, I always talk about the reporters that grovel when they want to write something that you want to hear, but not necessarily millions of people want to hear or have to hear.
So you've launched an investigation.
We're going to launch an investigation to find out. And then the next time, and I will say this, of those votes cast, none of them come to me. None of them come to me. They would all be for the other side. None of them come to me. But when you look at the people that are registered, dead, illegal, and two states, and some cases maybe three states, we have a lot to look into.
What do you think of that?
What Donald Trump was giving was the justification for nationalization of the voter registration database. So, and it's highly unlikely that he understands where that came from, what the objective is. They will do the study. They will find that there's fraud in the voter registration lists, and Jay Johnson.
You think this is leading to a certain place that's a predetermined place, and whether or not Trump actually knows, if he doesn't know, somebody's leading him by the hand and bringing him to this conclusion that we need this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's highly unlikely that he has even a clue what the whole scenario was about. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because these are IT people. They come up with the storyline, you know, for management, the reason, the justification for the system. You must always have a justification for a project because they cost so much money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just say we want to go do this, we want to take it over. You've got to have a justification, and the justification has to be significant enough. I mean, the crisis, whatever problem you're trying to solve, has to be significant enough to justify the cost and the effort.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. Makes perfect sense. And yeah, it would make sense if what you're saying is true and he doesn't know, that would provide the explanation for why it seems that he genuinely is trying to do certain things for the country. But then you got situations like Betsy DeVos, Trump's pick for the education secretary position.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a woman. Okay, New York Post just came out with an article. Trump's education secretary pick plans to get rid of Common Core standards. Now, I had Jason tweet this to me. I see that it's December 11th was the date. I didn't realize it was that long ago. I thought this was a more recent article, but they claim that, Betsy DeVos, you know, she's going to put the brakes on this contentious Common Core standards if she is confirmed by the Senate. And it goes on about, you know, her being a Republican donor, head of Michigan GOP. And I remembered seeing something about her that wasn't favorable. And I did some digging and I discovered an article at newswithviews.com, which was very helpful, which I'll put in the show notes. But she sits on the board of directors of Excel in Ed. This is Jeb Bush's organization, which is pro-Common Core. I mean, they're very cagey about it, but if you do some digging, I've got a page where they're funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and a whole lot of other organizations that we would recognize as being not on our side as far as anything. And then, let's see, I got the 2016, okay, here it is. The Robertson Foundation, Walton Family Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, $500,000 to $1 million they gave in 2016. There is the Schwab Foundation, Bloomberg Philanthropies, the Kellogg Foundation, News Corporation, Annie E. Casey Foundation. So it's a hodgepodge of various foundations, but Bill and Melinda Gates is in here as well.
Yeah.
These people are pro Common Core. They even have a frequently asked or a myth versus reality debunking page promoting Common Core. And this woman sat on the board of directors, and she's going to get rid of Common Core?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. If you go back to the Bush administration and look at what was being discussed, what was being worked on at the time, you'll find that the issues that were pending at the time are now what is being discussed again. Do you know how the Hollywood cars work, you know, for like chase scenes and stuff, and the driver gets killed but the car keeps going and stuff? Well, there's a driver in that car that's driving the car, but you just can't see him, you know, because it's a movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way our country runs. So it doesn't matter who we have as the president, you know, what person we're focusing on. The agenda continues. When the Democrats are in power, there are certain systems, certain functions that receive the press attention. When the Republicans are in power, it's the other set of issues and systems that receive attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everything proceeds on a path, no matter who is in place. It's just where the media focuses or where the political system puts their focus.
Yeah.
You see? And that's the way it works. So that's why I was so upset when he appointed Elaine Chao as transportation secretary. And Common Core, if you want to talk about Common Core, I mean, that goes back to George Herbert Walker Bush and the New American Schools Corporation that he set up, where he put together a board of directors of corporate leaders to redesign the American schools. And what did they come up with? What did they come up with? They came up with a vocational system.
There you go.
And a certification.
Which sounds an awful lot like what they're talking about at the World Economic Forum, which I want to get into some of the audio today.
It is, because all of these systems are global.
Mm-hmm.
They're all global.
Now, there's another thing that's worthy of mentioning here, and that's from the Los Angeles Times. They have an article out just yesterday. Surge in media mergers is expected under Trump's pro-business agenda. They say, buckle up. Media companies are preparing for some whirlwind courtships in what's expected to be the biggest merger bonanza in years. The latest corporate maneuvering has New York-based Verizon Communications Incorporated, the largest phone company with more than 114 million wireless subscribers, possibly pairing up with the Connecticut-based Charter Communications, which has more than 17 million customers in such key markets as Los Angeles, New York, and Dallas. Verizon recently approached a Charter board member to discuss the possibility of combining. The discussion was preliminary, and there is no certainty that such a tie-up will occur. People close to the companies cautioned Thursday. However, this romance and others appear to be blooming 1 week after President Trump took office and designated a new FCC chairman who favors a more hands-off approach to government regulation than his predecessor.
Right.
So, this is what we get to look forward to. Are we going to have one media company?
Yes. There will be one media company. There will be one corporation running the entire world. That's the way systems operate, you know, and a corporation is really nothing more than a system that accomplishes a mission, starts out with one mission, but they've broken away barriers so that now corporations can spin off holding companies and they can go into all different lines of business so that you ultimately don't know who owns what. But it's always a function of consolidation, expanding your share of the market and consolidating.
You know what occurs to me is that we're approaching the dictatorship of the shareholder.
Absolutely. Ultimately, yes. It will be a single global totalitarian system.
Very distressing. All right, we're at the top of the hour already. Hour number two is straight ahead. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back.
Govern America.
So just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is hour number two of Govern America. Mickey Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. And it continues to be the 28th of January, 2017, almost all through the first month of the year. And many more to go as time goes by very quickly. We've been talking about some of the corruption and how you have the changing of the guard, and yet the system seems to stay in place and continue on unabated. And that seems to be the unfortunate reality that we face every time we have a new president elected, or selected, depending upon how people look at it. I think there is some contest going on with regard to the presidential campaign, but at the end of the day, they comply. They do what they're told.
It's really the contest is whose team is going to be making the money. you know, that's really the contest. If you get right down to it, it's It's whose team is going to be making the money. And that goes clear down to the local level, too. It's not just at the national level or the big national contractors. It comes right down to the county level.
Well, there are some good things that are happening. And I think it's, we're still much better off. And I know it sounds funny to say it after what we just said, but we definitely did dodge a bullet, in my view, by not getting Hillary Clinton in there. Because things, I think, would have moved a lot quicker. Now, assuming Trump stays the course with some of the stuff he's planning on doing, and certainly it looks like he's trying to, at least, we do have the repeal of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was huge. As a matter of fact, the union leaders are all happy about that. In fact, Jimmy Hoffa was on Fox Business.
There are good things going on right now. The president talking about, you know, getting Ford to bring their production back. Those are going to be union jobs, good union jobs. Carrier air conditioning, those are good union jobs. So there are good things. Even Chrysler is talking about bringing their production back. Those will be union jobs. So I think there's something going on here could be very, very positive with regard to bringing back jobs that have basically left the country, bringing them back here. Those will be union jobs.
So it sounds like you're supportive of President Trump. I mean, he withdrew the U.S. this week from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was a big deal. A lot of CEOs were upset with that. They wanted to be part of the TPP. Why do you support the withdrawal from the TPP? Tell us from a worker standpoint.
Well, from the standpoint, this was basically NAFTA on steroids. We know with NAFTA that America has lost over 1 million jobs. These are good jobs that have gone to Mexico. And this was going to just accelerate that. Jobs would be in Brunei and Vietnam and other places. And we just can't have that. We've seen what happens when we have these agreements. So we applaud and oppose TPP forever. We oppose Fast Track. So we applaud the president when he basically said, we're getting out of TPP. That was a big victory for us, and that he'll renegotiate NAFTA. We support him on that. Yeah. Where the president we think is right, we will support him.
So tell us about that, because it's interesting that, you know, the unions could not bring the vote for Hillary Clinton. There were a lot of union members who were watching Donald Trump and saying, you know what? He's saying what we've been saying for 10 years.
Well, I've been saying about trade for 20 years. I mean, you know, finally somebody's listening, and I think that's good. I mean, this is a big development, TPP, renegotiate NAFTA. This is what we want to do, and we join him in that, and we'll help him. And that's very, very positive. We already see that these companies are blinking. They're saying, okay, I'll come back to the United States. I'm glad it's so simple.
How much influence do you think the unions have with the Democratic Party, James? I mean, I'm reading this op-ed this morning on Chuck Schumer going absolutely wild and ballistic on Betsy DeVos. He says this: Betsy DeVos would single-handedly decimate our public education system if she were confirmed. Her plan to privatize education would deprive students from a good public education while helping students from wealthy families get another leg up. Actually, that's not even true, because she doesn't oppose public schools. She wants competing models of public education.
Okay, we've already established that is true.
The bad schools get better. But it seems like the Democrats are just trying to stop all of the president's nominees for his cabinet.
Well, I think, you know, that's going to be between Congress and the president's nominees. But where we basically support the president where he's out there creating good union jobs. That's what we do. We can't support him on everything, but we know he's doing the right thing with regard to trade, with regard to a number of issues, and where we agree with him, we will support him.
Okay, I'll cut it off there. There was about another minute, 9 seconds left in that clip, but I think you get the idea. The unions are all in. It's hard to not feel at least a little appreciative of some of the things that have come down the pipe this week.
Well, the plan to privatize the schools, which is what she's going to do. I mean, Schumer is right in those terms. They are going to be privatized. They are breaking up the school system and implementing a vocational model of the schools. I mean, if you go back and you look at the evolution of legislation for the schools, the plan was that came out of the Gates Foundation, I think somewhere around 2001 or 2002, was to have small schools and for the young people to choose their vocation either in the 6th grade, the 8th grade, or the 10th grade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was a state choice. They could choose which one they wanted to begin the vocational education.
Yeah. Which it's basically a planned society.
Oh, totally planned society.
And it's the Soviet model.
Because it's all IT. IT people are driving the redesign of the management of society. So everything is planned. Absolutely everything. The young people will not have free choice. They'll choose their career, you know, say in the 8th grade, and that will be their vocational training.
Okay, do you think the allegations of the you know, close ties that Trump has with the Russians, you know, assuming that there is any ties whatsoever, but this allegation, you think the plan is because we know the Soviet model of education that you just described, well, that was in fact something. I mean, Charlotte Isherby exposed that.
So I'm wondering if
this Russian thing doesn't somehow tie in here.
Well, no, you really can't. Well, it's difficult to say because the Helsinki Final Act that was signed in 1975 provided for bilateral agreements with the Russians. It was the Soviet Union at that time, but in 1990, they had the August coup, and they broke up the Soviet Union into the independent states. But the Helsinki Final Act is still in place, and it called for cooperative exchanges between American and Russian scientists, educators, you know, professors at school, and that's what I blame really for what's happened to our university system, is that Helsinki Agreement and the exchanges of professors from the Soviet Union here, and the exchange of journalists from the Soviet Union here. It truly was a kind of trading places with the Soviets, and so they got our freedom, and we got their enslavement.
Wow. Yeah, you can see that really clearly. I'll tell you what, we got a call on the line, and if you'd like to join in, folks, you're welcome to do so. We're going to try to get it later on to the World Economic Forum as well. Not try, we're going to do it. I'm determined, because I got a lot of stuff there, and I'm going to be adding more to it as time progresses. I think this is going to be kind of a series, because there's so much audio there that needs to be examined. One thing that these people can definitely do is talk. They talk and fill a lot of papers with words, too. All right, I'll tell you what. Let's go to the phones and take the call. And the number, by the way, is 1-844-646-8376. That's 1-844-6-GOVERN. 844-646-8376. And hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Hi, it's Nick from Alberta.
Hey, Nick.
I got some solutions for you. I think you're going to really like them.
All right.
How fast do you want your rights back? And how fast do you want your education system fixed? Tuesday quick enough for you?
Can't come soon enough, I think.
Lay it on us.
Okay, well, I would like to shoot for Monday, but Monday you have to do what I'm going to suggest, and so Tuesday it'll be fixed. All of it, your rights, everything. You want to shut down Homeland Security and NSA and all of it, because your rights are being violated. I already gave you Title 18. Now I'm going to tell you what to do with Title 18. Did you see Donald Trump's inauguration speech?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I think you missed what he did. It was absolutely incredible. These people operate. See, they don't want to come out and tell you what going on and what's going on, because it'll panic the public. At least they think it'll panic the public, whether it will or not. So they operate, you know, in stealth in the background, and they kind of show you and, you know, kind of hint around it and use this legalese language. He said, I am transferring power from Washington to you, the people.
Yep.
Did he say that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he did.
Yes, something happened right before he said that, and something happened as soon as he finished saying that. Did you notice what it was?
The military in the background?
Probably not.
Are you talking about
That's
the military?
Right. When he, just before he said that, they came marching down the stairs, they stood there, he said his line. As soon as he finished the line, they turned around, and they went back up the stairs.
You know, I noticed that, and I wondered about it.
I'm going to tell you what he was saying. He was sending a very loud message to somebody, but he was, whether it was somebody or not, I don't know, but I know he was sending a very loud message, and the military was, to you, the American people. Our problem is with Title 18 or any of the other laws is there's no enforcement. The military said, you now have enforcement. So this is what you do with the education. We'll go with the education system for now. You go down, because they always do what Washington says, right? Washington dictates to them, and they do what they say, Common Core and the whole works. After World War II, the Japanese and the Germans, I don't know if it was both of them or just one of them, were put on trial for crimes against humanity. And one of those crimes that they were hung for was brainwashing the children instead of educating them. So that's what they're doing. They're brainwashing the children instead of educating them. Trump said it himself, deprived of all knowledge, he said in his speech. So what you do is you go down to your school board with the best curriculum that you can find. Dr. Pesta's got a good one, Dr. Duke Pesta. Go down there with it in your hand, to any school board, on Monday, and you put it right in front of them, and you say, as of tomorrow, you will be instituting this program. If you don't do that by tomorrow, you will all be arrested for crimes against humanity. Then you wait for the next day. If they haven't done it, you go straight to the provost marshal, because you're under martial law. This is a military situation. You go to the provost marshal, and you file charges of crimes against humanity against these people. Instantly. And they will take the military. That's why they were standing there during that particular part of the speech. They're telling you, you now have enforcement.
Yeah, I'm skeptical. Anybody's going to do anything. I really doubt that they're going to arrest
them. I know you are, but here's what the problem has been up till now. We don't have enforcement. Now we do, and they told you that we do. So every time people have gone, because you're still under martial law, every time people have gone to the military and said, why aren't you doing anything about this, they never once ever said, we don't have jurisdiction. The only thing that they've ever told anybody who went to them, they said, we don't have the support of the American people.
Yeah. Well, we got to get people that
are willing to support them.
Yeah, we got to get people on board.
You're willing to use them.
We got to increase our numbers.
Okay, but you don't have to have everybody.
No.
This is.
But we have to have a good number of people.
The better.
That's a very.
The more people you have, the better. But the problem, what you want to do is solve the problem. Damn the consequences of what the people think.
Well, they'll solve their problem and come and get you. Go ahead, Vicky. I'm just cynical.
You want to come and get me? Yeah, I know. I understand the cynics and all that. But he sent you a message. He transferred power from Washington to you. Now, let's say you're driving along, and your rights are being violated. Because if you get pulled over for a no seatbelt ticket, it's not about the seatbelt ticket. It's about fraud and your rights. As soon as you get pulled over, you say to the cop, okay, you're committing fraud, and you're violating my right to travel, my God-given right to travel. So let them write you a ticket. You take your ticket. You phone the police. You say, you got 1 hour to cancel this ticket and leave me alone. If they don't, then you go to the provost marshal and you say, my rights under Title 18 has been violated. Take a copy of that with you. Show it to the provost marshal. Say, I want these people arrested. File the charges. If the provost marshal doesn't do it, because he may not know. The higher you go up in the military, they do know. And they will enforce it. They have told you that they'll enforce it. They need you to go to them. They're not going to come to you. When you get your house robbed, the cop doesn't come to you. You have to go to the cop. So go to the provost marshal. They will enforce it for you. They will arrest these people. This is the only way it's going to get solved.
Okay, Vicki, let Vicki respond because I think she had something to say.
Yeah, I do. I wonder how that would work. You see, the Idaho legislature passed a piece of legislation that put our state courts under requiring them to recognize the international court orders from The Hague. It required our states to participate in a Hague convention in violation of Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution.
They're breaking the law.
The federal government extorted the state to participate, using the threat of funding for Health and Human Services. And it was an unconstitutional mandate. Because
so
it didn't meet the test. Where do you find the provost marshal? Where do you find that person?
Well, yeah, any military base will have one. Any military base will have one. The reason they're not doing it because nobody's filing the charges. It's better to have 1,000 people go down there and file the charges, but you only need one. That's all you need. And if he doesn't
understand or know,
you say, let me speak to your commander.
All right, let's just say I want to do this. Hold on. Let's just say I want to do this.
Uh-huh.
Is there a form that I request? I walk in.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, but you can sure find out when you go down there, couldn't you? And all you're doing is going. It's like going to the police department and filing.
Well, how do you know that they're going to
do
anything?
Because they stood behind Trump and said we're going to do something. That's what they were standing for. They weren't there during any other time of.
Yeah, but they could have just been moving around. No. I don't know that was a statement.
You better believe it was a statement, and that's how they talk. They can't come out and just tell you because the people will panic. Do it this way. Do it quietly, and I'll tell you, it will send a message to every school board and every police department in the entire country. And you make sure that they arrest them and put them on trial. Not threaten them, not intimidate them. Arrest them.
Okay.
They will do it. And if the provost marshal won't do it, because he may not know, the higher up in the military you go, they know.
Well, it's something
they
for somebody to try.
Well, somebody's got to try. If you don't care about your kids, you won't try. If you don't, that's what the military is saying. They're saying, we don't have your support. How can we do anything? If you show them you're willing to now use them, they will act for you. I promise you that's what they were standing there for saying.
All right.
Trump said we were transferring power from Washington.
Hang on. Go ahead, Vicki.
They'll do it.
Wait a minute. Go ahead, Vicki.
I would be willing to give that a try on this issue of S-1067. I wouldn't take a complaint to the legislature and say change it or else.
No.
But I would file a complaint with the provost marshal.
Not a complaint. Charges.
Because,
He says charges.
Not a complaint. Charges.
Well, a complaint is a charge.
Okay, well, you call it whatever you want, but you want these people arrested. You have to send a message to every school board and every cop. And when you go into a courtroom, people say, well, we're not under martial law. Yes, you are. You are at war. If you go into a courtroom, there's a yellow fringe around the flag. That's the war flag. Yeah. Every American citizen is considered an enemy combatant. Again,
yeah, well, that may be true, but if at the official level they don't recognize it, then you're spitting in the wind, you know.
I know, but we haven't had. See, they won't arrest each other, but the military will. They have sworn an oath, and that's why they were standing there, telling you this. Only during that portion of the speech. Watch it again.
All right, yeah.
How they act.
All right, we got it, Nick. Hey, I got to move on, but thank you. Thank you for the information. Thanks. And for the thought. Appreciate it. All right, there's Nick in Alberta. Any additional thoughts about that, Vicki?
It's a very interesting thought. I wouldn't do it, you know, like if I got pulled over and got a seatbelt ticket, because that is
well, there's a lot of ways that people can fight tickets in court.
Yeah, well, and it's too petty. It's too, you know, I wouldn't waste my time with it. But on this legislation.
Let me just say this. Frank Steffen over at American Voice Radio Network, we'll give them a plug. They're listening, by the way. Thank you for carrying the show. Greetings to all the folks listening over there. Greetings to all the folks listening to us on UCY.TV. Glad to have you along as well. Everybody listening on the micro FM stations, thank you for carrying Govern America. I just wanted to say that Frank has a show he does with Alfred Adask called the American Independence Hour. And they talk about this. You know, fighting these traffic cases in court all the time, and it's pretty fascinating. There are legal arguments that you can make, and you know, sometimes it'll work and sometimes it won't. But there are some pretty standard things that people try, and they're able to very effectively beat these things in court to the point where, you know.
Yeah,
the whole thing is based on fraud.
I'm sure they are, but I have bigger things on my mind than that. I have better things to do with my time than that, rather than, you know, a seatbelt ticket for me is $10. My time is worth a lot more than that. I'm worried about this big stuff. I'm worried about the constitutional violation. I'm worried about our a function of our government being done by The Hague. I don't want a function of our government being done by The Hague.
Yeah.
So.
Well, oops, anyway,
sorry.
That's okay. We number of different executive orders were signed this week, and I'll run down just some of the things that were done, because it's really hard to keep track of. Things are going at us at a rapid pace here now. We've got freezes on federal regulations pending reviews, which I think is fine. I think it's good. I think there's too many federal regulations now. There's freezes on federal fundings for NGOs using money for abortion. I would argue that we shouldn't even be funding any NGOs, so that's a good thing.
That reminds me of something that I wanted to say about Russia.
All right,
and
go ahead.
About Putin, is that he banned the Soros NGOs from his country, and that is the smartest thing that he could do, and we should do that here.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree, and that's part of the reason why I have a problem, too, because as we will get to some of the other stuff regarding this visit yesterday by Theresa May, they're all in favor of the NATO. You know, they talked about the reaffirmation of NATO. And I think, we need to be pulling away from the United Nations system. We don't need to be going further and further into it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Great Britain got us into this whole mess with the United Nations. I know
they were actually holding hands yesterday.
Who?
Theresa May and Donald Trump. They walked out of the White House holding hands.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
I mean, now, I'm sure it's staged for the cameras.
That's disturbing, though.
This is a symbolic gesture that the two, it's almost like a sick marriage.
Yeah. Well, our country has been, you know, I always picture the UK and the United States as the two guys in the story of Mice and Men.
Mm-hmm.
The UK is the short, wily, smart guy, and the United States is the big, dumb, retarded guy.
Interesting analogy. All right, we're at the bottom of the hour, halfway point of the show, flying by. Stay tuned. This is Government America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. We'll be back in a moment. We're back. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. The website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. And check out Vicki's website, thetechnocratictyranny.com. And moving along here, I wanted to get through this list real quick, if we can, with the executive orders and actions that Trump took, just to kind of give people up to speed a little bit on what. Now, as I said, hiring, you know, he froze the federal funding for NGOs using money for abortion. There was an executive order, and I'll put all these in the show notes, by the way, freezing federal hiring, a memorandum regarding construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, and another one regarding construction of the Dakota Access pipeline, trying to get them going. An executive order expediting environmental reviews and approvals for high-priority infrastructure projects. There you go, Vicki.
That's
one for you.
I know that.
High-priority infrastructure. Presidential memorandum regarding construction of American pipelines, pushing for the use of American steel only. Presidential memorandum streamlining, permitting, and reducing regulatory burdens for domestic manufacturing. Another executive order enhancing public safety in the interior of the United States. An executive order for border security and immigration enforcement improvements. Trump also signed two other executive orders that are not on this list. I was not able to locate the text yet because they're brand new. But they're in order to rebuild the military and Number two, implementing his program for extreme vetting. Now, you recall, and this is something I think is really good, this extreme vetting thing, because, well, let me just play this up. You know, basically what he's doing here is he's banning immigrants or, you know, illegal aliens, refugees from seven predominantly Muslim countries. They are Syria, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. Now, of course, you know, instantly heads are exploding at the networks.
Tonight, President Donald Trump greenlighting one of his most controversial campaign promises, signing an executive action to enact what he calls extreme vetting.
To keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States.
The order calls for suspending the refugee admissions program for 120 days from all countries, indefinitely suspending refugees from Syria, and opens the door to temporarily banning immigrants from additional countries.
We should only admit into this country those who share our values and respect our people.
Tonight, civil rights groups and Muslim communities worry Mr. Trump is targeting predominantly Muslim nations.
That is unacceptable. It is targeting a Muslim.
But the move was broadly popular among Trump's supporters.
I'm not so sure that it's a bad idea, but I don't know that it's a great idea either.
Trump initially proposed the inflammatory policy on the campaign trail last
December. Inflammatory policy. We're talking about securing
inflammatory.
Talking about securing our country here.
I watched a video saying that there are 50 Muslim terrorist training camps in the United States.
Well, you know,
mostly in the East, but a few of them out here in the West as well.
Well, we got to protect them.
Jay Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Words that sparked bipartisan condemnation and critics arguing a ban on a religion is unconstitutional. Mr. Trump changed his tone in the general election, aiming to broaden his appeal. But tonight, outrage and claims his executive order amounts to a Muslim ban by another name. The ACLU saying extreme vetting is just a euphemism for discriminating against Muslims. The Council on American Islamic Relations also weighing in.
He's sowing seeds of hatred and division based on religious bigotry.
In an interview today, the president saying the focus will be on helping Christian refugees.
Yes, they've been horribly treated. Do you know, if you were a Christian in Syria, it was impossible, very, very, at least very, very tough to get into the United States.
If you read the fine print of the executive order, it says Mr. Trump is also suspending immigrants and non-immigrants for 90 days based on a law that has cited Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. He's ordered his secretaries of state and homeland security to review the entire process.
Well, there you go. That's NBC.
You are fake news.
There you go. NBC. Why? What can we expect?
Well, see, that's one of those things that, you know, where they just throw logic out the window,
mm-hmm.
and we're just supposed to ignore the fact that
it's bigotry, you know, bigotry. Yeah. I tell you, to secure the country.
Yeah. Well, so be it.
Yeah, that's what I
don't really care.
Well, it's insane to say that it's discrimination against a certain religion when. You don't know. See, the thing is what we're talking about here is finding out who's actually coming in. You know, and the problem I have here is that the media and all these pundits and all these people that are promoting all this garbage, they're not making the distinction between immigrants and illegal aliens. You notice they call it undocumented and all this other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They got all these names.
Yeah, they started doing that about a decade ago.
There's a huge difference between illegal aliens and and immigrants. There's a lot of people who are immigrants and they go the right way. There is a process to come here. And that's the thing that gets lost, I think, deliberately in the conversation.
Well, you know what makes me really mad is that in 1987, when we went through this whole thing about granting amnesty to the illegals that were here, they were supposed to fix those systems so that we would never have that problem again. It was supposed to be a one-time thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And now they're trying to turn it into a permanent thing, you know. So people that came illegally after that and their children were born here, now we can't deport them because they have American children. Well, I don't personally think that the children of anybody that's here illegal is an American simply because they're born on American soil.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was also a lot of talk this week and exploding heads in the media about how the building of the wall along the U.S.-Mexican border was going to be funded. Of course, Trump also signed an executive order to start the immediate construction of a border wall. I think this border wall thing is largely symbolic because if you don't have the enforcement to back it, see, the problem is they have tunnels. They have a lot of other things. So you need a lot of things at the border. You really need the military on the border to patrol the border. Manpower.
They can find those tunnels. Yeah. I remember reading in the 1990s.
But I mean, the wall wouldn't stop that, is my point.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, they could find all of the tunnels and blow them up. I mean, those tunnels are true. There because nobody has bothered to look for them.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
They have earth penetrating radar. I mean, they know right. where the tunnels are.
Exactly.
So
that's a good point. Very good point. You know, of course, you know, Vicente Fox on MSNBC, you know, he pontificated about how he's not going to, you know, Trump's, because Trump's still saying he's going to make Mexico pay for the wall.
I think it's an understatement to say that you are no fan of Donald Trump, looking at some of the things you've said about him lately. Just yesterday, you said, when I saw today's gathering of the Republican Party retreat, Trump being there reminded me of Hitler addressing the Nazi Party, comparing Donald Trump to Hitler. What did you mean there?
Yes, comparing Donald Trump with Hitler and comparing the Republican Party with the Nazi Party, because they don't seem to have free mind. They don't have to decide on their own. They seem to be doing just exactly what Senor Trump proposed to them. I would say, Senor Trump, please grow up. I mean, now you're president of a great nation, of the most powerful nation in the world. Please grow up, be, or try to be a real
I agree.
President.
How condescending.
And keep throwing smoke balls. Your strategy in dealing with businesses is not the one to do in government and among nations. We take you seriously. As seriously that President Peña decided not to come to United States. It was not a mutual decision. It was our president's decision, because we are offended, because we've been harmed, and because you're affecting our businesses like Ford Motor Company. Ford Motor Company.
Your businesses. See, now it's their businesses.
Yeah.
You're affecting our businesses.
You remember when Mikhail Gorbachev was at the Presidio with the State of the World Forum? Vincente Fox was one of the intellectuals there working with Mikhail Gorbachev. So that tells you about
where he's
Vincente
coming from.
Fox.
Exactly.
So he banned, and now people is not buying Ford cars because you played around with Ford Motor Company. Now several Mexican states that buy units from Ford Motor Company are not buying anymore. Several corporations in Mexico have done the same. And now you move to how you're going to charge for the wall. How do you think that Mexicans are going to pay? Your proposal?
I'll tell you.
Yesterday was
so it? They got a plan for it. I mean, go ahead.
I know how to pay for it, how to make them pay for it.
Well, Trump's already outlined the plan, but go ahead.
Well, the Mexicans, the illegals that are here working and people that are here legally working, they transfer money back to Mexico to their families
that's
in
the
Mexico.
Plan.
Mm-hmm. All you have to do is just put a tax on those transfers on
that's
those
exactly,
monetary transfers.
That's exactly what Trump has on his website. What you just said.
Okay.
Yeah, I got the document. He laid that out in the campaign. The Western Union transactions and stuff. They send a lot of money back home, and
about
all you got to do
$50 billion.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Extraction from our economy. By the way,
yeah.
If those were Americans in those jobs, then the United States would get 100% of the benefit of that job.
Absolutely. but they're taking money out of our economy, sending it to Mexico. No wonder this piece of garbage is all upset. You know,
right.
Our Ford Motor Company.
50% tax on Mexican imports. Do you know who pays a tax when you import? It's the American corporation, the company that is importing the car. And if that car, Mexico will keep selling at 20,000, as an example, U.S. dollars, it will have a 4,000 tax paid by a U.S. corporation. And finally, the consumer will pay 24,000. Mm-hmm. Instead of 20,000 right. with its own pocket money. So Mexico is not paying for the wall. You
really?
Are paying for the wall. Taxpayers in the United States are paying for the wall.
Yeah, I think this guy is a little off, you know.
Yeah, I don't think he's thought it through.
I'm not going to pay for that f***ing wall.
Yeah, that's what he said earlier. Anyway.
Yeah, what I'd like to see happen anyway, you know, go ahead and keep those car manufacturers. I'd rather build cars here in the United States and go back to the kind of cars that don't have all the computer systems in them.
Well, I think they're going to have computer systems regardless. Unfortunately.
I wish they wouldn't. I wish they would just...
Oh, I agree. Because we're getting to the point where we're losing control of everything. You know, I'm not a Luddite. I enjoy technology. Obviously, we wouldn't be here right now on the air if I didn't enjoy technology. The problem is that I enjoy technology that I can control. When the technology gets out of the control of the person using it, it becomes a real problem. And that's where we're faced with the very real prospect of losing control of everything. I mean, everything is being turned inward and being weaponized against us.
Yeah. Well, my whole career was spent, you know, designing and writing computer systems and looking at technology and upgrading technology. I love it too. But I, like you, I want to control it. I don't want it to control me, and I sure as hell don't want the government controlling me, or corporations, or nonprofit organizations masquerading as government to control me. You know, if you don't I was going to buy a Rottweiler one time because we got burglarized, mm-hmm. and so we went to talk to. She ultimately decided not to sell us a Rottweiler. And the reason why is because she said, if you don't control this dog will control you.
Huh. Wow.
and that's the way technology is, you know. If you don't control it, it will control you.
That's a very good analogy, by the way. Tell you what, we got a call on the line. Let's go ahead and take the call. And I believe this call is from Missouri. And hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Yeah, how are you, Darren? Sam calling.
Hey, Sam. How you doing?
Not too bad under the weather, but that's okay.
Sorry about that.
Semi-functional anyway. I wanted to bring your attention, because you guys were talking about that whole issue of computers and cars, which I agree with you wholeheartedly on this subject, because if you do a search on YouTube, you'll find the story about a Spokane, Washington police officer who saved a woman from a burning car. Now, the interesting thing about this story is the reason this woman was trapped in her car wasn't because the car had crashed. It was because the power system in the car caught fire while she was driving, and she couldn't get the doors open.
Mm.
Oh, my gosh.
See, that's the problem I have with power windows, by the way. I've never really been a fan of power windows for that very reason.
So, good tip, have a hammer in your car.
Yeah, there you go. Just make sure
In fact, that's what happened. This guy had to bust the windows out to get this woman out because, now, see, the other thing you got to remember about these cars is that not only do the windows not work, but they have the automatic locks. When you put them in gear, they automatically lock the doors, so you can't get
so
the
you're
door
literally
open either.
A prisoner.
Wow, thank you for calling in and mentioning that. I will do that's something I will do something about.
Look that up, because I found it this morning. I was doing some research on some other stuff when I couldn't sleep, and I just happened to run into that, and I thought, wow, you know, it's like, that's about the worst possible fate you could be in. Now, fortunately enough, she survived it unscathed, but if it hadn't been for this guy being right there, she'd have been killed.
Well, I think there have been many that haven't, you know, survived things like that. You know, you hear the stories about people driving into creeks or ponds, and their car is sinking, and they can't get out because the system is shorted out.
Yeah. So I just thought I'd point that out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a horrifying thing.
I am really, really unhappy about the technology in cars, because hackable. And I don't care what kind of security they put on
there. You said it's hackable? We missed a part of that.
Yes, the technology is hackable.
Mm-hmm.
If there's chips and the chips communicate with other chips, it's hackable.
Yep, that's true.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, well, you know, and that really brings us to the World Economic Forum. Hey, did you have anything else, Sam, that you wanted to say?
No, that was it. In this particular case, I didn't want to stay in too long, but I just happened to hear you guys talking about that after I ran into this morning, and I thought, you know, I did want to make you guys aware of that story. It's out there. Just put in there, Spokane police officer saves woman from burning car. You'll find it.
All right, we'll do.
Hey, thank you, Sam. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Thank you. God bless. Hopefully you'll get over your cold there soon. All right, there's Sam in Missouri, and I wanted to get into this because there is some driverless car stuff in the World Economic Forum as well. I think there's some other stuff I was going to cover, but I think given the time, I think I should jump to the World Economic Forum. Let's see. Let's start here. First of all, we had of course, as I said, we had the meeting with Theresa May yesterday. They held a press conference, President Trump, at the White House with Theresa May. And, well, let me just share some of the comments that were made.
On defense and security cooperation, we're united in our recognition of NATO as the bulwark of our collective defense. And today,
NATO.
We've reaffirmed our unshakable commitment to this
unshakable
alliance. Mr. President, I think you said, you confirmed that you're 100% behind NATO. But we're also discussing the importance of NATO continuing to ensure it is as equipped to fight terrorism and cyber warfare as it is to fight more conventional forms of war. And I've agreed to continue my efforts to encourage my fellow European leaders to deliver on their commitments to spend 2% of their GDP on defence so that the burden is more fairly shared. It's only by investing properly in our defence that we can ensure we're properly equipped to face our shared challenges together.
Now, on the subject of trade, Theresa May had this to say.
And finally, the President and I have mentioned future economic cooperation and trade. Trade between our two countries is already worth over £150 billion a year. The US is the single biggest source of inward investment to the UK, and together we've around $1 trillion invested in each other's economies. And the UK-US defence relationship is the broadest, deepest, and most advanced of any two countries, sharing military hardware and expertise. And I think the President and I are ambitious to build on this relationship in order to grow our respective economies, provide the high-skilled, high-paid jobs of the future for working people across America and across the UK. And so we are discussing how we can establish a trade negotiation agreement.
Okay, now is she saying that the future of our jobs and economies revolve around defense? That's really a concern.
Take forward immediate high-level talks.
Go ahead.
Oh, that's because the technology systems that are being implemented are part of defense. The technology that they're putting in, the systems of government and everything, mm-hmm. It is weaponized.
Yep.
It's under the defense system.
So it goes back to what we were saying earlier, what I was saying earlier, about everything is being weaponized against us.
Mm-hmm. The groundwork for a UK-US trade agreement and identify the practical steps we can take now in order to enable companies in both countries to trade and do business with one another more easily. And I'm convinced that a trade deal between the US and the UK is in the national interest of both countries and will cement the crucial relationship that exists between us, particularly as the UK leaves the European Union and reaches out to the world.
Now, everybody has been wondering what was going to happen with the Brexit plan. And when that happened, I remember having my jaw on the floor here wondering how in the world could this have ever happened. Well, they've done something very, very clever here. They've redefined, they've taken what was really should have been a setback and twisted it around in their favor. Here's the BBC.
After months of waiting, Britain got some clarity today on what its exit from the European Union will actually mean. And it's going to be what's known as Brexit Max. Prime Minister Theresa May set out 12 key objectives for withdrawing from the EU. Key among them were that the UK will leave the single market but seek a free trade deal with it. Sterling rose on the news, but there's been criticism of the plan as well. The BBC's Andy Moore reports.
Good morning, what's the plan?
It was billed as the most important speech of her term in office. It was certainly the clearest exposition yet of what Britain wants from Brexit.
Not partial membership of the European Union, associate membership of the European Union, or anything that leaves us half in, half out. But I want to be clear. What I am proposing cannot mean membership of the single market.
But, she said, Britain would push for the freest possible trade with European countries and other nations around the world. For the first time, Mrs. May confirmed that the British Parliament would get to vote on the final deal at the end of the negotiations. Sitting in the audience were some of the ambassadors to the UK. Mrs. May emphasised she didn't want to undermine the EU, but she also warned against those who wanted to see the UK punished for voting to leave.
While I am sure a positive agreement can be reached, I am equally clear that no deal for Britain is better than a bad deal for Britain.
The opposition Labour Party said that Mrs. May wanted to leave the single market, yet still have access to it. That, they said, was like having your cake and eating it. And they warned against her negotiating position.
Throughout the speech, there seemed to be an implied threat that somewhere along the line, if all her optimism of a deal with the European Union didn't work, we would move into a low-tax, corporate taxation, bargain basement economy on the offshores of Europe.
That clarifies it all.
And that implication of a warning was picked up by the European Parliament's chief negotiator on Brexit.
I don't think we're going to make a lot of progress if this has to happen under threat, because our European counterparts don't accept it, we're going to make from Britain a sort of a free zone or a tax haven. I don't think that is very helpful. It creates also an illusion, the illusion that you can go out of the single market, that you can go out of the customs union, and that you can cherry pick, that you can have still a number of advantages.
Okay, we got to take the top of the hour break. It's interesting how they're twisting this around to mean something that the voters didn't intend. Stay with us. We'll be back.
Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro-FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is hour number 3 of Govern America. Mickey Davis and Darren Weeks here, as we are every Saturday. It's the 28th of January, 2017, and we're in hour number 3, the third and final hour, talking about this situation with Brexit and Theresa May and her address at the World Economic Forum we're going to get to here in just a moment. Vicky, did you have anything you wanted to say so far regarding the BBC piece that we just aired?
I think I did, but I forgot, so
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead.
Yeah, anytime you have anything to say, just jump right in there and okay. Don't, you know, feel free to interrupt. But
I know what I was going to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it was planned this way all along, actually, because Britain is an island, mm-hmm. and there are special provisions, you know, under the UN system for small island countries.
That's right.
And it's part of the whole logical island business, you know, that I think you've probably read about the port system,
mm-hmm.
Admiralty law and all of that. That's all British.
Yep.
I kind of think this was the plan all along.
Full chapter in Agenda 21 dealing with small island nations.
Yes. Yeah. Exemptions for them.
Yep. So, anyway, British Prime Minister Theresa May was at the World Economic Forum, and she was talking about Brexit and the way forward and how the system of globalization is being undermined.
Those of us who meet here are all, by instinct and outlook, optimists who believe in the power of public and private cooperation to make the world of tomorrow better than the world of today.
Hey, public and private cooperation. Don't you just love it?
That's because Fabian socialism originated in Britain.
There you go.
The British are brilliant at administrative systems, at manipulation and administrative systems. you know, you just really have to give it to them for that. They're just brilliant. And it was a British woman who came to this country and set up the derivatives market.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd love to give it to them, wouldn't we?
Of tomorrow, better than the world of today. And we are all united in our belief that that world will be built on the foundations of free trade, partnership, and globalization. Yet beyond the confines of this hall, those forces for good that we so often take for granted are being called into question. The forces of liberalism, free trade, and globalization that have had and continue to have such an overwhelmingly positive impact on our world. That have harnessed...
That was my spooky music, by the way.
...precedented levels of wealth and opportunity. That have lifted millions out of poverty around the world. That have brought nations closer together. Broken down barriers and improved standards of living and consumer choice. Forces that underpin the rules-based international system
rules-based
that is key to global prosperity and security are somehow at risk of being undermined.
Well, I love how she feels so threatened. And this is why my point in playing the spooky music. The storm clouds are forming. You know, this woman's clearly living in a bubble. I mean, look at all the wonderful things globalization has done for so many people. How could you be against it? Anyway, she continues.
And as we meet here this morning, across Europe, parties of the far left and the far right are seeking to exploit this opportunity, gathering support by feeding off an underlying and keenly felt sense among some people, often those on modest to low incomes living in relatively rich countries around the West, that these forces are not working for them. And those parties who embrace the politics of division and despair, who offer easy answers, who claim to understand people's problems and always know what and who to blame, feed off something else too. The sense among the public that mainstream political and business leaders have failed to comprehend their legitimate concerns for too long. This morning, I want to set out a manifesto for change.
Okay, now listen closely to this, because what she's doing here is just astounding.
That responds to these concerns and shows that the politics of the mainstream can deliver the change people need. I want to show how, by taking a new approach that harnesses the good of what works and changes what does not, we can maintain, indeed we can build, support for the rules-based international system.
Support.
And I want to explain how, as we do so, the United Kingdom, a country that has so often been at the forefront of economic and social change, will step up to a new leadership role as the strongest and most forceful advocate for business, free markets, and free trade anywhere in the world.
Okay, now what she's doing here is really clever. Okay, and I don't know if she thought of this or if the people surrounding her thought about this. She's redefining the meaning of the Brexit vote. Listen to this.
I speak to you this morning as the Prime Minister of a country that faces the future with confidence. For a little over 6 months ago, millions of my fellow citizens upset the odds by voting with determination and quiet resolve to leave the European Union and embrace the world.
Embrace the world. Gee, I didn't think that was what they were trying to do. Do you? I thought that they were leaving the European Union to divorce the world and reclaim their sovereignty.
They always planned to be on top. In 1919, I mean, that's what the whole British Empire was about. And the British Empire still exists. It's just that it's now called the Commonwealth of Nations. And it's the British Foreign Secretary that is the head of the Commonwealth of Nations.
Mm.
So,
well, I don't know that the people were thinking all that when they pulled the trigger.
Let us not underestimate the magnitude of that decision. It means Britain must face up to a period of momentous change.
Momentous change.
It means we must go through a tough negotiation and forge a new role for ourselves in the world. It means accepting that the road ahead will be uncertain at times, but believing that it leads towards a brighter future for our country's children and grandchildren too. So while it would have been easy for the British people to shy away from taking such a path, they fixed their eyes on that brighter future and chose a bold, ambitious course instead. They chose to build a truly global Britain.
Is that what they chose?
Yeah.
Did you think they thought they were choosing that?
Yes. Oh, the British people? I don't know. I don't even know that the British people, if their votes, I think this was the plan of the City of London, the British elite that run the City of London. I think it has been the plan all along, and that's what I mean, that the British are brilliant with strategy for administrative control.
See, that was kind of my theory after this thing happened. I was so gobsmacked, for lack of a better word, that it made me wonder, given the fact that the other side seems to be very good at rigging elections, I thought, well, maybe somebody wanted this for some reason. But I couldn't figure out why.
Yeah, I was not at all surprised about that they voted to exit. And I do believe that that was the plan all along on the side of Britain. Now, I don't think the people in the EU were in on the plan, but...
So there's a falling out, isn't it? Competition? Because I know that European Union is talking about building an army. And, of course, Britain is still in favor of the NATO structure. And in order to have a British or a European Union army, they have to have the unanimous consent of the European Council, which is made up of the heads of state of the various nations, the member nations. 27 of them, I guess, although if Britain leaves, it would be 26. So I don't, it looks to me like we're going to have, if they get their way, competing world armies. What do you think of that?
I think that's very possible. They'll have to cough up quite a lot of money because I think the NATO has been run by the Americans and the British for a long time. Have not really contributed as they should have on the cost of it. So it's just kind of breaking down along the same lines that it did, for World War II. Mm-hmm. It's a replay. It's a rerun.
Yeah. Do you think a world war is inevitable?
If people don't figure out what this whole global system is and how it's operating and why they do what they do, then yes, I think it is inevitable. If they do figure it out, then they will dismantle the entire structure that is bringing the world to the brink.
Yep. All right. Continuing on, I got a few more of her clips.
Some of our European partners feel we've turned our back on them. And I know many fear what our decision means for the future of the EU itself. But as I said in my speech earlier this week, our decision to leave the European Union was no rejection of our friends in Europe, with whom we share common interests and values and so much else. It was no attempt to become more distant from them or to cease the cooperation that has helped to keep our continent secure and strong. And nor was it an attempt to undermine the European Union itself. It remains overwhelmingly and compellingly in Britain's national interest that the EU as an organisation should succeed. It was simply a vote to restore, as we see it, our parliamentary democracy and national self-determination. a vote to take control and make decisions for ourselves. And crucially, to become even more global and internationalist in action and in spirit, too.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
See, we just weren't accomplishing the job quick enough. I mean...
Yeah. Mm. Well, the structure of the EU was pretty crazy anyway. I mean, they built that communitarian law system and... You know, just imposing ridiculous things on people. I don't know. Exit. I mean, you know, why would you put up with that kind of nonsense?
Yeah.
Like they have been doing.
Well, you know, I don't know. I guess I'll play the last couple of clips here. Hopefully they're kind of short.
Because that is who we are as a nation. Britain's history and culture is profoundly internationalist. We are a European country and proud of our shared European heritage. But we are also a country that has always looked beyond Europe into the wider world. That is why we are among the most racially diverse countries in Europe, one of the most multicultural members of the European Union, and why, whether we're talking about India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, America, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, countries in Africa, Asia, or those that are closer to home in Europe, so many of us have close friends and relatives from across the world. And it is why we are, by instinct, a great global trading nation that seeks to trade with countries not just in Europe, but beyond Europe too.
Okay, now I find it interesting that at the time that this is going on, you know, assuming your thesis that her, you know, that this was all pre-planned and orchestrated and this is what they wanted over there, I think it's interesting that at the time that that is going on, at the exact same time we have Trump coming on the scene, pulling us out of NAFTA, at least conceivably at this point in time, NAFTA could end up being dead. And that, to me, would be a victory, although would it really be a victory if the plan is to do globalization another way? I mean, well, Trump wants to focus upon bilateral or one-on-one negotiations with trade. And to me, that would be the way to go. If you're going to agree with something, instead of having these groups of nations, some of whom are, you know, completely unbalanced in terms of their GDPs and, you know, what they have, I mean, inevitably, you're going to end up losing when you're negotiating with people who don't have a market. That was my problem with George W. Bush and his promotion of this CAFTA idea. After NAFTA devastated our economy, he came along and started saying, we need to open up these markets. And I said, what markets? They're all poor.
Right. Well, but after the trade agreement, they wouldn't have been, because the way those trade agreements were structured, they used the United States as the purchaser of goods produced in these foreign countries to build up their economy.
Right.
But they were destroying our economy in the process.
Okay. Well,
and now, yeah. One thing I want to point out to what that woman, Theresa May, said. When she listed off those countries, all the countries she listed off are the Commonwealth countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's her regional organization. That is the UK regional organization,
mm-hmm.
is the Commonwealth of Nations, British Commonwealth.
The British Commonwealth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I just was repeating it because we missed a little. We were having a little bit of Skype issues now, worse than usual.
I think they used the UN to convert our country into being a colony. A return to a system, a colony of Britain.
Yeah, well, Joan Vion always talked about that. How we, you know, if we ever really left, and there's a lot of people who speculate that we never really left control of the British, But regardless of whether we did or whether we didn't, we seem to be reverting right back into it.
I kind of think we didn't. I think we thought we did.
Yeah.
But I think the British outsmarted us.
Well, and that would explain why we have all these Brits on TV over here.
Yes, everywhere. Absolutely.
Every time you turn on the TV, you got the BBC World News America propagandizing the American people. You have other people, other news anchors, and even comedians with British accents.
Yeah, well, and the whole system that we have operating now with public-private partnerships and the systems of certification, you know, of associations, that's all the British system of livery companies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where a livery company is basically given a patent on a profession. The Bar Association is basically a livery company.
Hmm.
The Bar Association has a patent on the system of law. Well, and if your association controls law, you control the damn country, right?
Yep, that's true. All right, moving along here, got one more clip from her.
So at the heart of the plan I set out earlier this week is a determination to pursue a bold and ambitious free trade agreement between the UK and the European Union. But more than that.
And that explains why she was here, by the way.
We seek the freedom to strike new trade deals with old friends and new allies right around the world as well. I'm pleased that we've already started discussions on future trade ties with countries like Australia, New Zealand, and India, while countries including China, Brazil, and the Gulf states have already expressed their interest in striking trade deals with us. It is about embracing genuine free trade, because that is the basis of our prosperity, but also the best way to cement the multilateral partnerships and cooperation that help to build a better world. For the challenges we face, like terrorism, climate change, and modern slavery, don't stop at national borders, nor do they stop at the borders of continents.
No, you can be a global slave.
The challenges and opportunities before us require us to look outwards in a spirit of cooperation and partnership. That is why, as I said in my speech on Tuesday, I want the UK to emerge from this period of change as a truly global Britain. The best friend and neighbour to our European partners, but a country that reaches beyond the borders of Europe too. A country that gets out into the world to build relationships with old friends and new allies alike. And that is exactly what we are going to do.
So there you go. There's Theresa May. Man, that woman creeps me out.
Well, and okay, Serco. You know who Serco is, right? The biggest company you never heard of?
I probably have heard of them, but because you've mentioned them probably before, but refresh my memory.
They are a technology services.
Oh yeah, I remember you writing about them.
Contracts with government for government functions.
Mm-hmm.
They're a British company.
Hmm.
Goldman Sachs is chartered in Great Britain.
Hmm.
They're not an American company. They are British.
Well, I guess I didn't realize the Goldman Sachs thing.
Yeah, Cantor Fitzgerald, same way. They were one of the businesses that were selling U.S. treasuries. They were in the World Trade Center. You know, when it was...
Well, and the Council on Foreign Relations, which we have here in the United States, this globalist spook think tank has its origins in Britain, from the Britain Royal Institute for International Affairs.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah,
speaking
I think of... Somebody told me that the livery company system in London is a logical island. It's actually not, it's like D.C., Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. It's not actually part of the U.K. It is a separate international zone. Well, the which is a port city, okay? It is a port city. The whole global system of port cities is part of the British network because they all operate under Admiralty law. The maritime, they call it the maritime, but it's Admiralty.
Yeah, CFR Tahel is in the chat room. He dropped a link in there to a video people can check out. The biggest company you've never heard of. And so that's the chat.governamerica.com. As we continue on here, speaking of secret societies, as I was a moment ago, with regard to the Council on Foreign Relations, I would consider that kind of a secret society. They certainly get together and conspire for world government. John Kerry was one of the panelists at one of the World Economic Forum venues or conferences or whatever you call these things, sessions, I guess, for lack of a better way of describing it. And this kind of follows up on our conversation last week about Trump possibly being targeted. You know, we were talking about the Dominique Popolo or whatever his name was, who had ties to the Clintons, who had made threats. So I thought it was worthy of pointing out what John Kerry said at the World Economic Forum. I thought it was kind of bothersome.
There are a lot of people here, Mr. Secretary, myself included, who are walking around with a pit in their stomach, a fear that so many of the things you just articulated and achieved could be reversed in a week.
I don't believe they will be. I just don't believe that. I mean, take Iran, for instance. If the United States were to decide suddenly and say, hey, we're not going to pursue this and so forth, I'll bet you, I haven't talked to all of them, but I'll bet you that our friends and allies who negotiated this with us will get together and that Russia, China, Germany, France, and Britain will say, you know what, this is a good deal, we're going to keep it. And Iran and the rest of it, and they will keep it. And we'll have made ourselves the odd person out. We'll have injured our own credibility in conceivably irreparable way. Not irreparable, things, time, and yeah, that's just too dramatic. But we will have done great injury to ourselves. And it will hurt for the endurance of you know, a year, 2 years, whatever, while the administration is there. But it's unnecessary because...
A year or 2 years, whenever the administration is there. What did he mean by that? Does he know something? Does kind of make you wonder.
Yeah, it does. What I also noticed, too, is that he is confusing his interests and the State Department's interests with the people of the United States.
Oh, of course.
Their interests are not our interests.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's just profoundly arrogant, but everything these people do is profoundly arrogant. Now, the World Economic Forum also held a session called Britain and the EU, The Way Forward, and one of the panelists' names there was Nari Wood, or actually Nari Woods, plural. She was pushing for the free movement of human resources in a knowledge-based economy, Vicky.
For Britain to succeed in a global economy, which it can, it needs to be right at the forefront of the knowledge economy. One of the great assets that Britain has is it has four of the world's top universities. I'm very privileged to work at Oxford University, currently the world's number one university. The fact that we have four great universities is a magnet, not just for students and faculty, but for companies all around the world. What most jeopardizes our status is immigration constraints. That we're fighting against top universities in the United States. We have to be as attractive as we possibly can. If we can't equal their package, which is come into a graduate degree at Oxford and then stay in Britain and work for a couple of years to finally polish your CV and then go home or go somewhere else, then we lose our attractiveness. And already we can't do that. Our students have to study and go straight home. If we have a tone in Britain, which is that it's less welcoming of immigrants, then Britain can't attract the best talent from all over the world. It doesn't become global Britain. It becomes doors shut Britain. if we continue to include students from all over the world in our immigration numbers, instead of seeing them as willing purchasers of Britain's fantastic educational services, if we make them part of Britain's immigration numbers debate, we're smashing our own kneecaps before we even begin the race. So what I would say to Brits and to the government is, in taking and embracing the world, in wanting to become a great economy in the world, don't kneecap your best asset. Let us thrive. Make sure that immigration policies tell the world that Britain is open and welcoming to the best, most entrepreneurial, energetic talent from all over without restraint and constraint, because then we can compete with other European countries, with the United States and beyond.
So,
you know what?
It's the same argument.
What she's doing there, they do not intend to do that. They will continue to take as many students as they are now, probably. What she was doing is marketing the concept to here, to the dummies over here in the United States. And the importation of foreign IT workers are coming from where? The British Commonwealth countries, India primarily. Basically, I do believe that Indians have essentially taken over our government. We have a lot of Indians, people from Commonwealth countries running our systems of government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you don't, the IT systems of an organization, whether it is the government or whether it is a corporation, the IT systems are the brains of the operation. And you cannot run a big organization without your IT systems. So whoever controls your IT systems controls the organization.
You know, and the listener may be wondering, why do we talk so much about IT? Why do we talk so much about tech? Because this is what the system is going to be. This is the new world order, as Parag Khanna would say.
It is. Everything is about the systems.
It is entirely a technocracy. Patrick Wood has it right. The new world order is a technocratic enslavement. It is literally a prison of wires, fiber optics, and routing switchers. It's astounding.
Right. And it's a redesign of our systems of government, combining them, integrating them into a global system of governance. And I'm not sure who's holding the keys to the global systems. It might be the OECD. I'm pretty sure that it's the OECD, but I can't say that 100%.
For the listeners, what is the OECD?
Oh, it's the Organization for Economic Cooperation, something like
and
that.
Development.
It was the successor to the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was started in 1948 to rebuild Europe. In 1960 or 61, they changed their mission because their mission over in Europe was done.
Mm-hmm.
So they converted to, first of all, look to the Latin American countries, which is what we were doing in Latin America all those years, you know, with Sandinistas and the Nicaraguans and all of that stuff. It's because they were trying to do economic development down there. So economic development is the Trojan horse, and the OECD, the successor to the Marshall Plan organization, they are the organization that basically is running the new the economic development as the Trojan horse.
It's a lot of moving parts. with this system. And
there are
people really need to be able to keep track of all of this. But
I captured a lot of pages, you know, when I was first trying to figure this out about the whole reinvention of government. And there was on the front page of my old website, channelingreality.com, on the right hand side, there I have a section on the reinvention of government. And one of those sections has images of an organization that was involved in the reinvention of our government systems. It was called PUMA, Public Something Administration.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an organization of the OECD.
They got a link here.
You talk for a second, and I'll find it.
Well, they got a link here in the for the Organization for European and Economic Cooperation. That is another OECD or OEEC, I guess.
OEEC was the original. It was changed to OECD. Just put in OECD.org.
Okay. All right. Let me move on to the. There was another session called Governing Globalization. This is pretty important. How can the governance of international economic integration be improved? Now, in this session, they asked the question, who are the winners and losers of globalization? Now, there's a guy, Dambisa Moyo, actually is a female, was one of the panelists, and she was born in Zambia. And is an international economist and postgraduate degrees from American University, Harvard, and Oxford. And she worked at the World Bank in the 1990s and Goldman Sachs in 2001. She's currently on the board of Barclays Bank, a beer company, SAB Miller, and Barrick Gold, which is a global mining company, I guess, for gold. Anyway, she's a major player, very well educated. I think it's important to hear what she has to say.
If we take a step back into the 1980s, we were promised, and certainly in the Washington Consensus, we were promised a suite of goods, essentially. We were promised free trade in goods and services. We were promised, which is also a key pillar of the globalization agenda, cross-border capital flows. We were promised, and with clear intention, that there was going to be free movement of people. And then, of course, as part of the Washington Consensus, there was a discussion around the size of government. If we take the snapshot of where we are today, we know that there continue to be massive protectionism before the Trump sort of wrath of protectionism coming. We already know that the World Trade Organization has talked about trade declining over the last decade, and the fact that even just in the last year, according to the Global Trade Alert, we've had about 644 new tariffs imposed, and the most aggressive being the United States. Cross-border capital flows, you mentioned I sit on the bank board, and we know since the financial crisis we have seen increasing capital controls which have limited cross-border flows. If you look at the International Institute of Finance data, we actually are seeing flows to the emerging markets that are so low. The last time we saw them at those levels was in the 1980s. And then in terms of immigration, we know that the agenda has not become globalized. We have the World Trade Organization on trade, IMF focusing on governance around cross-border capital flows, but we've never had an international agency focused on immigration. We'll come to that discussion later, but I think just to answer your question very succinctly, who were the winners, who were the losers? Clearly, the losers have been farmers in emerging markets because many of them are facing subsidies through the EU, farm subsidies in the United States, EU caps, the CAP program, the Common Agriculture Policy Program, so they've not been able to sell their goods into the international market. Other losers, clearly, in the United States, middle class. We know the story about real wages. We know the story about living standards and the deterioration and a lot of the social metrics, not just for minority groups, but also for mainstream Americans. In terms of winners, and I think many of us put our hands up, it is clear that there has been a decrease. And if you look at the income inequality between countries, there has been a decrease over the years. So, you know, coming to the point about improvements of society, reduction of poverty, I mean, those statistics are clear. And I think the reason President Xi was speaking on behalf half of globalization is China, with his, I think the number he quoted was 700 million people moved out of poverty in the last several decades. That is definitely on the back of globalization. But I think one of the things that we are going to have to come to terms with here is that there have been significant losses, and it's not clear to me that we'll be able to remedy them under the current infrastructure.
Now, I give this woman credit for recognizing some of the problems and not glossing over them. I'm not sure what she means by the problems are unlikely to be solved under the current infrastructure. Is she saying that globalization needs a major overhaul? If so, that would kind of fit into your thesis that some of the things that we're seeing regarding changes in these in the globalist structure might be deliberate. But I think at least she, you know, some of the a lot of the people here. In fact, we're going to hear from Brad Smith. From Microsoft, these people are pretty sociopathic in terms of the fact that they do not see, they do not recognize the suffering of other people. At least this woman seems to at least pay homage to the fact that there are people who have real problems adjusting to what they're foisting upon the world.
Yeah. Now, which session was that? Because I want to go back and listen to that. The mention of the Washington.
It'll be in the show notes. Everything we do is in the show notes.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I'll have the link right there to all of these sessions that we're covering today. But anyway, they turned to Brad Smith speaking. Like I said, this guy is the president and chief legal officer of Microsoft, who was addressing the question of whether or not globalization was a net benefit.
You take your first question, has globalization been net good? Well, there was a Georgetown University study last June that said since 1989, the U.S. economy has added 35 million jobs. If your definition is net equals overall, 35 million additional jobs in 26 years is very good progress. What is more insightful is then to see how it breaks down. The number of jobs held by Americans that have a four-year college degree or higher has risen 107%. It has more than doubled. And the rate of growth, the slope of the curve, is remarkably constant through Republican and Democratic administrations alike. Now, if you look at the so-called middle-skilled jobs, those that require a post-secondary credential, typically a community college degree, those have risen by not as much, by 47%. And the slope of the curve has been much more jagged. Now, the really amazing thing is what has happened to jobs that are held by people who have only a high school diploma, a secondary degree, or less. It has fallen by 13%. There are 7.3 million fewer jobs in the United States today than there was in 1989 held by people with only that level of education. And if you ask people, including me, well, would more trade have solved that problem? I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know, it requires a different solution. Now, your question sort of points to both an additional aspect of the problem and part of the solution. Those 26 years have been a time of increasing trade and massive technological change. It's not as if automation is just starting in the year 2017. A lot of these jobs that were adversely impacted have been eliminated by technology at times. And you know, what we have to think about in the future is what jobs will be added, but equally important, what skills will be needed. If we don't understand what skills will be needed, and if we don't match those
there's a few seconds left.
People with the right skills with the new jobs, then actually, whether it grows on net probably doesn't matter unless you actually don't need a net.
Just go ahead, Vicki.
Yeah, it's real hard for me to listen to that because his statistics are pure crap.
Well, the woman that was there, she took issue with some of this, you know, because what I hear him saying is pretty much the same type of argument that John Kasich used, you know, which we played a couple of months ago on the air, this idea that in order to prosper, people must be retrained and, you know, the whole concept of lifelong learning.
You know, right, exactly. And how many, it just drives me crazy. You know, if you watch a lot of those videos that they have at the World Economic Forum, you can hear from session to session how they contradict themselves. the whole problem is that globalization has just been fabulous for a very, very few people.
Yeah, the people that are talking at the World Economic Forum, largely.
Yes. And they wring their hands about, you know, redistribution of income. Did you watch that one about the idea of the guaranteed income, guaranteed basic?
I think I did.
Yeah. Well, and the reason why they
if
they
I
don't,
if I didn't watch that one yet, I have it in my the things that I downloaded from there. So we'll get to that.
Well, the very wealthy don't, of course, want to give up their gravy train. And so, you know, their idea is perhaps we should have a guaranteed income for people who will never be useful in the labor market. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which is really, it's true. It's true. Most of the world's population are not necessary for a globalized, technologically enabled world.
Right.
Most people cannot participate in that technological economy. They just simply can't.
Well, and that's just too bad for you, according to these people.
Right. And so do we think that these rich people...
And they address that in here, by the way.
Yeah. Do we think that they're going to give people a basic income? Well, yes, maybe for a while, long enough for them to get their SEPI program going and the Gavi program for pandemics. And
there you
and
go.
And then we will have.
If you're a useless eater, you got to be done away with. And that falls in line with Agenda 21's depopulation agenda. You know, in the aerial spraying that, you know, Bill Gates is all in favor of, the geoengineering of the planet, it all fits together. You know, the vaccinations, you know, let's see. Oh, yeah, I got it right here.
First, we've got population. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, health care, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
That's the agenda. That's the agenda, Mr. Rich Billionaire. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, you know, and the Wellcome Trust, when I did my study of the healthcare system, the redesign of the healthcare system,
mm-hmm.
and the connection to the Human Genome Project, I knew what they were going to do with the poor people that were not going to be able to participate in this new economy. They're going to monetize them by using them for DNA, for genetics research. That's what they're going to do. They'll give them basic annual income long enough to be able to use their body for genetic research. And when they're done with them, they'll get a hot shot.
Yeah, boy.
And I hate to be so blunt about it.
Well, that's just the way it is.
I get so frustrated, you know, because it's so obvious. It is so obvious.
Yeah. Well, they continued on with the subject of advancement of technology and specifically automation. Automation eliminating jobs. Another one of the panelists was Stefan Lofven, who is formerly a trade unionist and has now become the Prime Minister of Sweden.
I was telling our moderator about a quote from a local trade union representative at the SKF factory in Gothenburg. He later became the mayor of that city. And he said, when he was asked by a journalist, this is two decades ago, the company had invested in new technology, which also meant that they need fewer workers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked by a journalist, are you not afraid of this new technology that actually takes away jobs from this factory? And he said, no, I'm afraid of the old technology. And I think that it's a very wise response, because he also understood if we do not use this new technology, the whole factory will be gone in perhaps 5 or 10 years. So the thing is, and also we need to be aware of this, you cannot stop the development of new technologies. It's impossible. It will happen. And we need it. It's a good, basically a good thing. The things we need to be aware of is the availability for everybody? Is it available for everybody? The competence, the knowledge that you need to handle this new technology, that's the basic thing. The Swedish Society for, I think that's also two decades ago, but don't take that exactly, put a lot of resources into giving people in general a knowledge about computers. How do we deal with computers in our daily lives? This is not only for those who can afford a private course, who can and can do it on job. This is for everybody. So there was a training, a nationwide training, and also not least giving incentives for people to buy computers, mm-hmm. financial. So all of a sudden, there was a broader acceptance of computers in the country. And that's my third point. This requires some kind of dialogue, some kind of process that involves different actors, businesses, of course, enterprises, but the society and the workers, the employees and other actors, so that we have a process where everybody feels confident, this is also good for me.
That's great. So one of the ways of thinking about what you just described is, should the priority be on protecting jobs or on protecting workers?
No, protecting jobs is that's a dead end street.
That's a dead end street.
It's a dead end street.
No, we don't care about that.
You cannot tell the market what to do or not to do. These inventions, they will happen. It will occur. So, and that is why we focus in the Swedish society on protecting individuals, giving them. I mean, jobs will be lost. It's inevitable. My own company was closed because ABB decided this plant is going to be closed, and so we were 300-400 people losing our jobs. And the point at that time is we cannot decide them not to close. We did fight. We did give them a fight for 3 years.
Yeah.
But after that, we saw this is going to happen. So what do we do now? How do we help the individuals to a new job? Some could go from this company to another company directly. Some needed training.
Yeah.
So so you provide them with training. You ask the company. You will support this process. The society needs to support this process. And some went out in unemployment. And during that unemployment time, they need to know, I can make a living.
Yeah.
I need the financial security during this time and make this unemployment term as short as possible going back to job. But that needs cooperation between the individual, your own responsibility, the company, the enterprises, the society.
And the state.
And the state.
So you were reskilled after your plant was closed to be prime minister?
Yes. There was one course that nobody else saw that one. And I saw that there's one for prime
Sweden
minister.
Sweden is a model for everyone.
Yes.
Based on that alone.
Yeah.
So I guess we all just should run for prime minister if we get out.
Yeah,
first.
Right. Well, it's good to know that they are using the proves what my theory that they use this same playbook all over the world. They just culturally customize it, you know. But his story is basically the entrepreneur in the garage story, with you know the slight variation.
Yeah,
prime minister, and the strawberry picking brain surgeon, my very favorite, you know.
The theme I'm hearing over and over again from listening to these sessions at the World Economic Forum is, in order to stay viable, you have to find a niche that other people don't find. You know, in his case, he became prime minister.
Yeah,
well,
that's
how many
a
people
real
can
niche,
do that?
Isn't it?
Tell you what, we got a caller on the line. I believe this caller's from Dallas. Hello, caller.
Oh, what a great show as always.
Hey, thank you. How you doing, Mark?
Here we go. I'm doing good. Let's keep going down this same road. The you know, we talked before, and you kind of touched on parts of it. You know, we're watching the expansion of the administrative state. Let's go to the next level, and this entails the expansion of the insurance industry. No longer do you just have life insurance. You have health insurance. You have prescription drug insurance. You have car insurance, and you have car repairs insurance. You have home insurance, and you have home repair insurance. You have identity theft insurance. You know, our complete existence as men and women in this country is going to be financially tied to our deductibles.
Yeah, well, and where did the insurance business start? London.
Yeah. Yeah, but and what that really does you to is when insurance takes over every aspect of your life, where in other words, where nothing's out of pocket anymore, you know, you pay a set fee and your deductible, of course, determines how much you end up paying. But it removes the very, it removes supply and demand from the equation, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, supply and demand is dead anyway.
All right.
Sorry?
I said supply and demand is dead anyway because of the monopolies. I believe that they're using Amazon to determine demand.
Right.
They will use Amazon in the future to determine demand. We don't have a capitalist country anymore.
No. But insurance does remove that completely. And if you look at the way the whole structure of the way that insurance is put together, that's why we see such an increase in cost. It's not necessarily because it's the price of the product. The price of the product goes up because nobody's having to pay out of pocket. If we pay
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, Mark. I think what it is, the global market. Okay, I was listening to a hearing, and it had to do with these EpiPens. And the EpiPen cost, I don't know, it was a couple $100, $150, and it went up just exponentially to a huge amount of money. And they were questioning the CEO, why did it go up so much? Well, she wouldn't say, but I suspect that her company is owned by a holding company, and that holding company is offshore somewhere. And what they are doing is extracting wealth out of the U.S. Healthcare consumer.
Well, and what do we got to look forward to for this replace of Obamacare, this replacement? I'm afraid we're in for a Trojan horse here.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Everybody looks for solutions looks for the answers to problems within our own economy without considering the globalized economy. I'm not sure how many businesses that we interact with that we believe are American businesses are actually American.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wonder who owns our hospitals? Because the price of
they're all part of a hospital group, usually.
Well,
ours,
in other words, it's not just one hospital. There's several hospitals underneath one company's umbrella.
Ours
right,
was supposed
but
to.
Who is that company that owns all of them?
Well, I don't know, but ours is a part of a conglomerate that supposedly it was a nonprofit organization, and then they were taken over by Henry Ford out of the Detroit area.
What? Henry Ford?
Yeah. Yeah, originally it was supposed to be University of Michigan, and then they had already labeled everything with the U of M logo, and then I find out that whole deal broke through, that they never were owned by University of Michigan, and supposedly they were going bankrupt and needed to do something to stay solvent, and anyway, they were taken over, I guess, by Henry Ford, or at least forged a partnership with them.
Okay. Well, let me tell you something. They're building a global healthcare system all over the world, you know, but in particular over in Africa, you know, different countries over there. In order to put high-tech computer systems for healthcare over there,
we're just about.
They need roads, they need the fiber optic cable for telecommunications, they need all of that stuff. Who is paying for that? Who's paying for it? We know that American technology companies are building the systems and selling the systems, but who is paying for all that infrastructure?
Well, we are.
Of course we are. You bet we are.
Well, we're just about out of time. Man, sure goes fast. Mark, thanks for calling.
Thanks for letting me on, you two.
Hey,
okay.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Mark.
Blessings to you. We'll talk later. And Vicky, as always, great show. Thank you for being with us. Folks, if you appreciate the broadcast, tell somebody about it. Spread the word and bring folks with you when you come next week. In the meantime, pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. We'll continue with the World Economic Forum and whatever the week brings all next week. God bless you. We'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.